Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. I think we didn't expect such a fantastic turnout, so I think it's a credit to both our speakers and also the controversial topic that they're addressing. And I think we have two very eminent speakers tonight who are going to be talking about this very, very current and topical issue of balancing the gender mix on boards. I think that we're all really well aware of the research in recent years on the outperformance of companies with women on their boards. And this research, of course, has been very well documented and communicated by the likes of Catalyst, McKinsey's, Goldman Sachs and others. The continuing issue, however, seems to be how we transform Australian corporates into great outperformers by creating more gender balance in our boardrooms. David Gonski is a very firm supporter of greater gender representation, but is on the record as saying that he hopes we do not go to quotas because, quote, those who advocate quotas know where it goes and could mean women were token board appointments rather than earning jobs in their own right. Liz Broderick, also a great advocate for more gender balance on boards, is on the record as saying that what isn't measured doesn't count and that there are factors at play in Australia which absolutely necessitate the need for gender-neutral quotas. Ladies and gentlemen, this will indeed be an interesting and lively discussion, and I would now like to introduce Liz Broderick, lawyer, businesswoman and currently Sex Discrimination Commissioner and Commissioner responsible for age discrimination, and David Gonski, well-known businessman, chairman and board director. I think Liz, you and David have decided you'll speak first. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Carol, and it's a real privilege to be introduced by such a wise agent of social change as Carol Schwartz here tonight. Let me begin by acknowledging that we are meeting here on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and to pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Well, today I want to do three things. Firstly, I want to examine the data, both here and internationally, about the gender mix on boards, because I know we all come from different backgrounds and different degrees of knowledge about that. Secondly, I want to make some brief observations about what I think needs to be done. And thirdly, and finally, I want to talk specifically about the issues of targets and quotas. But before I start, let me acknowledge the contribution that my co-presenter, David Gonski, has made to this debate. He's really placed the issue of women's underrepresentation on boards in Australia right on our national agenda. And as many of you know, he has been a long-time advocate for change. He's encouraged male business leaders to take some responsibility for the situation that currently exists, but also to take responsibility for changing this picture. And I know that he's worked in both the public and private spheres to educate, to cajole, and to influence others to take action. So I really commend you on your leadership, David. Thank you very much. Look, David and I agree on many things. We are in strong agreement that the current representation of women at board level is unacceptable in this country. We also agree that much more needs to be done, that we need a change of direction. We agree on what success looks like. Where we have some divergence of opinion is on how that change might occur. And that's why I think it's so important that we continue to debate and discuss these issues. And that's why I'd like to thank the Sydney Institute, particularly Gerard and Anne, for providing a platform for that discussion. And I'm really pleased to see when I look at the board of the Sydney Institute, almost 40%. And when I look at the women that are there, I know they're punching above their weight. They're some of the feistiest women I know, so good on the Sydney Institute. But also thank you to Clayton Utes for providing this venue and also for being a long-time supporter of the Sydney Institute. So let me outline the problem. These are the facts. Australia is leading the world on women's educational attainment. That is, we are educating our women better and longer than almost any other country in the world. And when we look at the university and tertiary statistics, the majority of university graduates are female. But despite this, we have a declining rate of women's workforce participation. In fact, in the last year, the World Economic Forum Gender Gap report has told us that Australia has dropped 10 places in 1 year. So we're going backwards, and that includes at the senior leadership level. Here in Australia, 59% of women are in paid work. That compares with 62% of women in paid work in New Zealand, 67% in the UK, and 70% in Norway. And I'm sure you'll agree that women start with the same level of educational attainment, if not better, because of our statistics. But women start with the same level of intelligence and commitment as men. But the reality is that they're missing in action at the most senior levels. And I think to illustrate this, we need look no further than corporate Australia. EOWA, the Equal Opportunity in the Workplace Agency, their 2008 census told us that only 8.3% of board directorships are held by women. When we're looking at ASX 200 companies, women chair only 2% of boards. And when we look at the management level, at those 2008 stats, 2% of chief executive officer positions are held by women. And I think the most disturbing statistic is that only 5.9% of executive line management positions, their positions that have responsibility for profit and loss, only 5.9% of those positions are held by women, and that's down from 7.5% in 2006. And just 2 months ago, the Governance Metrics International, which is a global ratings agency, they released their data that discloses our global position. In their March 2010 report, Australia was notable for two reasons. Firstly, we have now dropped behind all our OECD counterparts on the number of women on corporate boards, with the exception of Japan. And secondly, we've had the largest decline over the past 2 years, together with Hungary, Peru, the Philippines and Poland. So failure to change this picture of leadership in Australia will put us at a significant disadvantage internationally. We have a huge wastage of female talent in this country. There is no nation or government, no industry or sector which can afford this kind of loss. Without significant intervention by business, by government, the number of women progressing in the workplace will shrink even further. Solving the problem isn't easy. We know that because if it was, maybe we would have done it by now. It's difficult and complex. And I think part of that is because up until now, much of the focus has been on fixing women, on providing assertiveness training, mentoring, networking and self-branding strategies. Look, they're all important, but by themselves, they're just not enough. Most of the discrimination that exists today is not overt. I see it every day in the work that I do as a sex discrimination commissioner. It is built into the systems, the cultures and the institutions that exist in Australia. It's often the result of an unconscious bias, a bias that relies on our inbuilt gender schemas that develop as a shorthand way of trying to understand and process information. But in summary, the barriers to women's workforce participation, they really fall into three categories. Firstly, belief barriers, and there's two deeply held beliefs that we have here in Australia. One is what the ideal mother looks like, the ideal worker, and the ideal worker is someone available 24/7, no visible caring responsibilities, usually male. And the second one is what the good mother stereotype. We believe here in Australia that a good mother is always with their children. So they're belief barriers that are holding women back. The second one is cultural barriers, that the systems that we have in place in our organisations, systems about selection, promotion, career development, they often reproduce disadvantage for women. Not often deliberately, but that's the impact of them. And then the third barrier is structural barriers. And hopefully one of those will be removed on 1 January 2011 because we will have a paid parental leave scheme, which is a huge step forward for this country. But the other things are about lack of affordable childcare, lack of, you know, accessible childcare. I meet women every day who tell me they pay to actually go to work. So solving the issue of women's underrepresentation requires some kind of system intervention. It requires us to devise a new approach, a new plan, and new solutions. And I want to make a few observations about what our new plan should include. Firstly, our plan can't be confined to change amongst women, nor can it be just about change between men and women. I firmly believe that we will not see significant progress until men start working with men to actually solve this problem. I mean, after all, it's men who dominate nearly every institution in this country, particularly in corporate Australia. And if there is to be a change, it needs to be male CEOs and business leaders that have to champion it. And that's why it's so terrific to see men like David and other concerned and passionate advocates who are prepared to pick up that advocacy mantle and to lead by example. That's my first observation. Second observation is that we need to see this issue of women's leadership in the broader context of gender equality. And people say, you're a human rights commissioner. Why do you care whether educated, articulate women are actually on the top of, you know, on boards or at senior level across our country? It doesn't threaten basic humanity such as food, shelter, housing. But let's be clear, there's a strong connection between how women are treated in corporate and business life and how women are treated everywhere across our country and internationally. The statistics on women's leadership reflect our progress towards gender equality, just like the stats on sexual harassment, just like our record on addressing violence against women, the gender pay gap, or the disparity in retirement savings. And as Irene Lang, who's the president of Catalyst, a big think tank on gender in the US, she said, look, until women are equitably represented in leadership in the private economic sector, they will be marginalised in every other arena. But that's the equality argument. But we must also not forget the research that Carol referred to, and that is that increased corporate performance correlates with greater gender diversity at the senior level. So there's no causal link, but it's a strong correlation. And whether you prefer the justice or equality argument, or you prefer the profitability, let's improve corporate performance argument, the outcome's the same. We need more women at the top. My third observation then is we need to be clear about what it is that we're working towards. And as a mother of a young boy and a young girl, I want to work towards a future where neither of my children's decisions or ambitions in regards to work and family are dictated by their gender. I want a future where men and women are equally represented in all forums of leadership, influence and decision making. So in practical and business terms, what does this look like? Well, as Jan Elsner, one strong leadership commentator, said, she said, look, we need to build critical mass in the presence of existing barriers. It's critical mass that will create the change that we're talking about. And I think it's an important point because it's critical mass that will create the change rather than the other way around, that change will create critical mass. So when I think about what we need here, I'm thinking about in the corporate sphere a minimum of 40% of each gender on all company boards within 5 years. And I think my fourth observation is that once we've agreed what it is we want, then we need to put all the options and the possibilities on the table. It should be our ambitions which define the methods and tools, not the other way around. Without significant change in our approach, the only thing we can expect is more of the same. So I want to finish now by talking specifically about targets and quotas. In efforts to promote women into leadership roles, there's no doubt in my mind that there was a major turning point about 12 months ago in relation to the thinking on quotas and targets. Up until then, the prevailing view was that the system was merit-based and that the problem was with women who either wouldn't or couldn't step up and take high office. But in September last year, there was a major conference about women on boards. There was agreement. Australia was going backwards and was likely to descend into free fall without some systemic intervention. And at that time, I agonised over whether or not I would use the Q word, yes, whether or not I'd call for a mandatory quota for women on boards. And after much consideration and having followed this for 20 years, I decided that we needed a lively debate about quotas and that that type of debate would be an important vehicle for identifying common ground and for calling business to action. And it's so reassuring now to see that we can have the open discussion about targets and quotas, that these words have become part of a mainstream debate and they're being used by many people, senior directors, both male and female, across the country, people who probably 12 months ago would have been aghast at the very suggestion. So change is happening. The government announced just last week a 40% minimum gender neutral target for all federal government boards to be achieved within 5 years. And I was interested in the Minister's speech launching that part of her election commitment. She said, "The federal government will lead by example." And there have been changes in the ASX Corporate Governance Council's reforms, and in fact David will talk about that in more detail, but they represent the first systemic intervention in this area. And the good news is that the statistics from the Australian Institute of Company Directors show that whereas in 2009 5% of appointments to ASX 200 boards were female, in the first 6 months of this year, 25% of appointments to ASX 200 boards have been female. So that is a really significant jump. But my question tonight is, these are promising signs, but will they be enough? And with this in mind, I want to talk about quotas, or what might accurately be called temporary special measures. The hostility towards temporary, David. The hostility towards quotas in Australia has long been held not just by men, but it's also held by women. There's a pervasive view, at least in certain circles here in Australia, that quotas constitute favourable treatment for women and that this will undermine the principle of merit by either promoting women who clearly are not up to the job or by undercutting women in the workplace by creating the impression that they're not actually there on the basis of merit, they're only there because of the quota. So I think we need to talk openly about the principle of merit and what it means. It's a very good principle. It aims to ensure that leadership selection processes are fair, that they're impartial and transparent. It means the outcome isn't based on where you went to uni or where you went to school or who mum and dad know. The merit principle is intended to eliminate favouritism, nepotism and bias and, of course, sexism. But unfortunately, it's now being used to defend just that. It's time that we started to apply the merit principle to women, and quotas are one way of bringing women's merit out into the open. Now, when Michael Lavarch, who was the previous Federal Attorney General, when he amended the Sex Discrimination Act back in 1995, he anticipated that one day we might need temporary special measures, including quotas. And he was clear that these sorts of measures should be presented and understood as an expression of equality rather than as an exception to it. And by this he meant that there's a difference between formal equality and substantive equality. Are we interested in equal chances or equal outcomes? Sometimes we just have to treat people differently to get true equality. And there's any number of arguments against quotas of why we shouldn't consider quotas. Some have suggested that as the ultimate say on board composition in the private sector belongs to shareholders, they are after all the owners of a business, that quotas would cut across the powers of shareholders to choose the directors who will be accountable to them for the stewardship of their investments. So the argument goes that it's owners that invest in their companies and risk their money. They should therefore have the right to decide who they want to represent them on the board. But shareholders' decisions have never been completely unfettered. The introduction of quotas would only mean that if a female candidate was put forward who was unacceptable to the board, then we'd need to find an alternative female candidate. Others have argued, well, that's fine, but there will be insufficient supply of appropriately talented women to fill the positions if quotas are introduced. And to that I say, look, if Norway can find 1,000 women in a population of 4.5 million, you would think that we could find 430 women in a population of 22 million, because that's what we need to get to 40% on ASX 200. We need an extra 430 women. And if we want to just double, and I'm happy with doubling over the next year or so, we only need an extra 130 women on ASX 200 boards. And having recently been involved in the Australian Institute of Company Directors, their mentoring program, and I was involved in helping the matching, I have no concern about the supply of appropriately talented and qualified women in this country. The current issue is with the demand side of the equation. So there's a host of all other arguments. There's about 10 other arguments here that have been put as to why quotas are not a viable option. And in this address, I don't have time to address them all. But in closing, I wanted to refer you to an entry on a blog about quotas, which followed an article that I wrote speaking out about quotas a couple of months ago. And the blogger's name is Tim Chapman. He writes, "There are really only two conclusions to draw from the evidence presented in Elizabeth's article. Either women are, as a sex, inferior, or there's a problem in our culture that requires going beyond eliminating structural discrimination. As a man, I agree with the assessment that men have to take equal responsibility to address what is clearly a fault within our society's current culture. Quotas are an excellent idea. They are a jolt to the culture, a culture where after a full generation of women in education, the statistics in Elizabeth's article are a great disappointment. I agree that quotas wouldn't be without problems. They would result in many individual cases in which maybe better suited men were passed over simply because of their sex. And as a man, I may one day myself lose out because of a quota system. But even hundreds of such individual cases cannot be compared to the fact that currently half of our society are not getting the opportunity to contribute to the best of their potential. I'd gladly miss out on a few jobs I deserved if it meant that our culture changed to the point that in my daughter's lifetime, women were participating proportionately across a range of occupations without the need for a quota system to get them there. Because if we let things continue at their own pace, it will not be my daughter's generation, but perhaps my great-granddaughter's generation, and that's too long to wait." I felt like saying when I read that, "Tim, where are you? Can I marry you?" You know, would that be appropriate being sex discrimination? Given that I'm already married, fortunately my husband's not here, but undoubtedly, look, there will be resistance to these new solutions because they're challenging the status quo. We have to expect that. But the more men and women that we have on board, the greater will be the pace of change. And I think it's important for women, let's not just talk amongst ourselves. Let's find the men that also know that we need this change, and let's urge them to start speaking up where it really makes a difference, and that is at the top. Because here in Australia, gender is back on the agenda. Let us build a strong and sustainable economy, an economy based on the skills of all our people, an economy that recognises and rewards the contributions of men and women equally. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a long time since I was doing university debating, but I did come into this and I agreed in these hallowed halls to do this debate because I was pretty sure that Julia and Tony would only have one conflict, and I thought, where else would you go but here to hear some sort of histrionics? But let me firstly say, if you are looking for a big debate between Liz Broderick and I, you have come to the wrong place, and the exit is right there. I respect Liz immensely. I've watched her career over time. She's done a wonderful job. But for quotas, she'd be a perfect person. And I will, if I may, give just a few comments before I get into her on quotas shortly, and also I might say into Tim the blogger. Let me firstly also say I welcome some of the people in this audience who have been at all three of the speeches I've given, and I apologise to them in advance if the points that I give are exactly the same, but it just proves that I believe in them. Let me also start by saying I am disappointed, as a male, that the number was in 2008 8.3% of the top 200 listed companies' directors were female. I'm pleased, though, and Liz did acknowledge this, that now the number is 9.3% and that it has grown in the last 3 to 6 months by 1%. It's not 40, but it's on its way. I find it amazing, let me start by saying, that in fact we have got these sort of problems in terms of the top echelons of business. Because interestingly, as a chancellor of a university, I don't see that in my university. When I go next door to the children's hospital where my wife works, I don't see that either. And when I go to Prince of Wales Hospital, which is usually as a patient, I am very lucky to have and surrounded by the top women who run that place and run it so well. I might say when I was on the board of St. Vincent's, the nuns did that job and they were also women. The fact is, this is almost quite unique. And I did see and listen to Liz's figures, but there is something particular about the for-profit sector that actually is running behind. The next point I would also say is quite obvious, that I feel quite relaxed as a citizen of New South Wales, knowing that my Premier is a woman, that my Governor is a woman, that my Prime Minister is a woman, and that my Governor General is a woman. I have no problems whatsoever with that, and I believe the land continues to survive and thrive. So why is it in business that we're falling behind? Well, as those who've heard me before, I believe there are about three reasons. First, and Liz mentioned that, because men, and I accept it's men, have come to the conclusion that there are no suitable candidates, and I'll come back to that. If pressed, some men would say that women don't fit in to the boardroom structure. Most boardrooms now do have loos that are either unisex or both things, but that wasn't the case when I first became a director 28 years ago. And finally, there is what I call the self-fulfilling prophecy, which is that we want people who are experienced on boards to be on boards, and therefore if you're not on a board, you can't possibly go on one. And if you're a neurosurgeon, I want you to have done at least 3,000 cases before you operate on me, and as women are not prevalent in boards, therefore they shouldn't be invited. Let me just take some of these excuses and look at them. The most important, and Liz did mention this, is that in fact there isn't a talent pool sufficiently developed to go on boards. And I actually think that if you define who you want on a board in a particular way, that is the right conclusion. If you, for example, want somebody who's over 6'6" and has played men's football for the last 30 years or fought in the male army, probably women would not apply, and nor should they be right. Here, we talk a lot about the fact that boards should be made up of CEOs. And indeed, many boards only look for people who have led companies at the most senior level. I freely say, and many have heard me before, that as a person who's never been a CEO, it's quite amazing to me that for the last 28 years I've got any board appointments whatsoever. The fact is that we don't need only CEOs on our boards. And the fact also is, and I'm quite positive on this, that a board full of CEOs would be one of the worst boards you could possibly have, because you need somebody who's prepared to accept that they're not the boss. And it seems to me that as soon as you say you don't need CEOs only on board, you need a few, of course you do. They're great managers and great business people. But if you extend it, suddenly the pool that you can look at in terms of gender gets enormous. We all know very well the fine women who've come through law, the fine women who've come through medicine that I referred to before, the designers in our thing, the consultants. All of them, in my view, my idea of a board, have a place on a board. So I reject the first excuse, which is the most common, which is that there isn't a pool there. And I might also say, if we're just going to look at the lack of women in senior positions, for those of you who followed one of the great, in my view, women business people of our time, Sook Kon, who runs Singtel in Singapore, there was a wonderful piece on her in the Singapore Straits Times, where she was asked, why in Australia do you have so few people who are female in senior ranks, and yet in Singapore you don't have the problem? And her answer is quite impressive. What she says is they have a different family structure in Australia. They don't have a home where there are different age groups to look after their children. They don't have the childcare facilities that we have here. She made it quite clear, and it's quite interesting, somebody who's actually there can determine that. And I would suggest that we've got to help and fix that problem, as Liz says. The second argument, which probably doesn't really dignify any thought, is the question of whether they would fit in. And there is actually an issue there. I've said, and I've said many times, that my concept of a board is like an orchestra. You cannot possibly run a major company if everybody plays the timpani. It'll be just a mess of drums. You need violinists. You need viola players. You need flautists. You need clarinetists. And it is the same on a board. You need diversity. That is why I suspect Carol's numbers are probably right, where it says that it's proven that having females on boards is a correlation to success, because it's an open-mindedness. It's the use of everybody in the community rather than just trying to get the timpanists to actually run the place. I might say, which actually I do believe in, that gender is the issue of today. Age will be the issue of tomorrow, and I do believe there is a place for older people to be on boards. I don't believe that women don't fit in. I think it's essential that they be allowed to come in, and if we are going to have a situation where they don't fit, then change it. Because if you change it, you will optimise your business. If you don't change it, you'll end up with old people like me sitting around the board, and I've got to tell you, the concept of sitting on a board with seven other people just like me defies not only gravity, but something that's worthwhile doing. So how do we achieve this? Well, Liz mentioned that the ASX Corporate Governance Council has come up with what I think is right. But as chairman of the ASX, you'd expect me to say that. But the fact is that I think saying to corporates, you must have a target. I have no problems with targets. You must have a policy in terms of gender, and you must report annually how you're going. This is what we would call, if not, why not? And I believe it's going to shame people over time, because we're all winners, particularly those that are listed companies. We want our constituents to believe we're right. I think people are taking it seriously. They're certainly asking us a lot of questions on what we mean on that particular philosophy. I believe it is the way to go. The second thing that's going on is the mentoring scheme that the AICD, the Australian Institute of Company Directors, has started. There are, under, as I understand it, 56 chairmen who have signed up to mentor one or two females to try and make sure that they're not only board ready, but move to the next stage. If you take Liz's number, that she only needs 430, I assume it's female places, because actually one woman could do all the 430. Basically, if the 56 were able to find two or three directorships for each of their mentees, we wouldn't be there, but we'd be quite a long way along the line. I think the shareholders, as Liz said, have a stake in this. They should, for the benefit of their business, and particularly where businesses are consumer-based, want 100% coverage of the consumers, namely to have women on the boards, and as such, they should be asking the companies that don't have sufficient representation to change that. And I absolutely agree, and I'm going to butter up Liz here because I'm about to not agree with her, but I absolutely agree with her that it is a problem of men. And I think we do have to change, and I don't think, by the way, that there are only a few of us who think this way. I think it is growing, and I think, frankly, it's changing very much towards the majority that believe they've got to do something. So what you might say, where's this debate? So let's come to the debate about quotas. I'm quite impressed that Liz has become such a politician that she now calls quotas temporary special measures. I think, Liz, I'll vote for you wherever you go. But I would also have a few other temporary special measures that I might like 100% taxation. That would be great for government revenues. In bad times, perhaps we'll remove the board totally and put somebody else in. My philosophy is not that you don't need some sort of impetus. But my philosophy is we are a country that must allow business to have some freedom, to make their own decisions. If they don't come to this decision, firstly, I think they'll fail in time because they're not in tune with what's going on. They're not great businesses. But the second point I'd make is we don't, and I know that Liz had 10, she was going to give me 10 arguments, she actually only gave 3 and then forgot the other 7, but I'll take the 7. But in terms of her one, she said, well, people basically say that putting women on boards in a quota means that they'll be seen as inferior. I absolutely agree with that argument. I think, and I have experienced it, let me tell you, in terms of overseas boards, where I have, on occasion, not the one I'm on now, been the notional Australian on the board. Where's Australia? The Americans dominated the board anyway. I didn't like it. I didn't like it one bit. I was there, I thought, because of me, because of who I am, not because I'm Australian. I would not like to be a woman put on a board because of a quota. I don't think that's the right way to do it, and I believe the pool is big enough for there to be merit in getting it. Temporary special measures or not, we shouldn't go that way. Because the third point is actually obvious. You start with quotas, which is quite right, you want women on boards. The next step is maybe you want representation from those who work with the company. That's not done too well in Germany. That's not done too well in Norway, dare I say it. But do we really want it here? Is it the right thing? Then we start maybe wanting officials from the government on boards. Why do we want to do that to businesses? Why do we not extol the virtues of the change, making people proud to be involved in it, rather than compelling them? I put an argument, and I felt I should mention this, the last time I spoke on this, which I thought was a real clanger, and that really got rid of quotas, and the Australian Financial Review thought it was one of the most stupid arguments ever stated. So I'm going to put it again. The argument goes this way, that if a company goes under or has some problems, if the government has legislated who is to be on that board, and I'm not saying the names, just that they have 40% women and whatever, whatever, and it fails, I believe it provides an excuse for mundane operation. Because what I would say is, if I had been allowed to change the board the way I wanted it, and to have got experts in these fields, we would never have failed. And as a lawyer of many years, even though the AFR doesn't agree with me, I do believe it's a valid argument. Because it illustrates what the freedom of companies is about. We need the best people, and the best people include women. And they should be there because they are the best. We do not need shotguns to make us do things. We must find ways of going for excellence because it's the right thing. So, in conclusion, and I promised Liz's twin sister Jane I would go easy on her. So that's my easiness, Jane. I believe that Liz and her group have done the most wonderful job. But I don't think we need the threat of quotas. It is obvious to anyone with half a brain that to exclude what is basically 52% of the population from boards that are involved in selling and dealing with the population is nutty. And we have to allow them to come in on our terms, which are that they come in as who they are, not because the government tells us, and not because basically we're compelled to do it. My view is, men are pretty stupid, but they will realise that. And that in the years to come, companies that don't transform their boards and take the best of the population, which includes women, and indeed may get to 40% fairly quickly, would be, in my view, on the scrap heap. Don't give them the excuse by legislating so that they can say it was the government that destroyed them.
Well, thanks to Elizabeth Broderick and David Gonski. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7, and there are a lot of people here, so if you just keep your comments or your questions brief. Before I call the first question, thanks, as Elizabeth Broderick said, to Clayton Lutz for this fine facility. The talk's been podcast tonight. They'll be up on the Sydney Institute's podcast tomorrow, and the papers will be published in due course in the Sydney papers online. So we come to questions and discussion. Catherine Lumby.
Thank you both. That was, both obviously very cogently argued. Can I ask about the Armani-suited elephant in the room? To both of you, really, this question. And it's something that Liz raised in her talk. I mean, when we talk about structural discrimination against women, and we talk about the armies of women who've been, like myself and like Liz, and we're of similar ages, through arts, law degrees and so forth, I mean, the reality is that for those of us who have children, as I do and Liz does, I'm sitting next to my husband, an ex-Blake's lawyer, who very bravely stepped up to the plate and for a number of years looked after our young infants so I could continue my career. And I think the stat at that time was 1% of men in the middle class were prepared to be primary carers for young children. And that's what's allowed me to go on and become a professor at the university, of which David Gonski is Chancellor. And the reality is that in corporate culture, isn't it true that it's still women who overwhelmingly are asked to bear that responsibility? And that is what causes for so many women a huge hiatus in their career and changes their career path. So comments about that impact on who gets onto boards and gets up to senior levels.
So maybe if you just, both of you, come up here and stand either side of this and then be quicker. So we start with Elizabeth, I'll go over.
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree with that, Catherine. And I think the comments from the woman at Singtel just absolutely goes to reinforce that. I mean, to shift the caring or more equitably sharing
the sharing of paid and unpaid work between men and women in this country. The time usage diaries, and we have some of the best data in the world on this, shows that that hasn't changed in 20 years. So the fact is that is a very difficult thing to shift. What I think is that companies, and we're talking about corporate Australia here, they need to recognise that men and women have different life cycles and to take that knowledge and intelligently apply it into the systems that exist in corporations so that jobs come in all shapes and sizes, and that's senior. The most senior jobs come in all shapes and sizes, and I think to enable women to make that progression, because they don't drop off just before the summit, the research shows they drop off about 5 years before, to enable that to happen we need two things. We need attitudinal change and we need job redesign, and I don't know any companies in Australia who are actually seriously investing in those two things.
And I don't have much argument on that. The one thing I would say is that it's my view that to change the way we think is absolutely fundamental in corporate life. If you are not a CEO, by the time you're 45 or 50, you're forgotten. Anybody who works in a university knows that the average age of the vice chancellors is 58, 59. Now, why is it that they're 10 years older? One of the reasons is, firstly, we're living longer. Secondly, there's a lot of things to do before you become a vice chancellor. Talking of your point about flexibility, etc., I don't understand, firstly, that if a woman would like to look after her children, why she has to be on the scrap heap because her group of males that came through Arts Law or whatever before have already moved on. Why not just keep going? Because let me assure you, that group of males will be used up by the time they're 60. And there is no reason, particularly as now you can have pilots who are 68, according to the new thing, flying you wherever, because they're young and brimming with energy, why can't one actually go back and still do it all? And we have to be more open to that. And we will allow ourselves more talent and, I believe, more ability to build our company stronger.
Carol.
David, I'd just like to make a little quote that Catherine Fox wrote in one of her articles. She said, "To describe a company where nearly every single member of the senior ranks is male, Anglo-Saxon and over 40 as a meritocracy is simply an admission that those using the term do not understand the bias with which they view the world." Now, you just said that if government mandated a certain number of women, then a board would not be able to appoint the experts that they need for the board because why? Because there aren't as many women experts as there are male experts. And also, I just wanted to ask one other question. You also said that corporates must have a target according to the new ASX rules. So what's the difference between a target and a quota for corporates in that context?
The corporate sets its own target.
Right. So
that's the easy one.
Would you be happy with that?
Then I may not be happy. It's nothing to do with me at the exchange.
Right.
But you as a shareholder read that this is a company perhaps selling dresses to women that has a target of 2%. I can imagine it will go straight in the bin and you will sell your shares.
Absolutely.
So that's fine. I don't see any problem with that.
Are you relying on
shareholders?
Carol,
we're going to keep going. We've got to answer this because otherwise, yeah, okay. Right. Just respond, yeah.
Yeah, look, can I just say, the first thing is I believe the targets set by corporations are very different to quotas. Secondly, in terms of quotas, basically meaning that, you know, there isn't the meritocracy there, that's not right. The fact is that I can't foresee, neither can government, what you will need in the particular vacancy that you're looking for. You as a chairman, as a board, as a set of shareholders must determine who is best for the company. Now, it may be that it is something that only a male can do. Maybe it is something that's aerodynamics or something, that's what they're interested in. May also be, by the way, that only a woman can do it. I believe it is something that has to be determined for the need. Now, what I also believe, by the way, is that women can stand on their own two feet and be counted quite happily, and one shouldn't be trying to bombard with legislation to try and do this, because there are other things. What happens if we decided to legislate that you must have people who are, for example, non-citizens of Australia on every board? Where's that going to take us?
Just a brief comment.
I do think here we're talking about the majority of a population and trying to make sure that the system works for the majority of a population. So I take the point that are we on a slippery slope if we introduce quotas for women, then what about immigrants, what about Indigenous people with disabilities, whatever. I just think that if a system's not working for the majority of this population, we need to start saying, well, what can we do to make the system work? And actually the quotas will be the jolt, as Tim says, or they'll be the possibility that we can realign the system. And I take your point that we need excellence, David. I absolutely agree with that. We can't take that woman who's walking down there and say, now you're on the BHP board. We need someone who absolutely understands that industry and will make a valuable contribution. But the idea that there would not be sufficient women and that we would have to look to the pool of men, and that's what a quota would mean that we had to do, I just don't accept that argument. I think there are women who are experts in trade and agriculture and aerodynamics and finance and whatever. We just have to go out and find them, and we have to start growing them.
Can I don't want to get our chairman offside, but just one very quick thing.
Okay.
This is absolutely a question of philosophy. I am arguing squarely that I don't believe that governments should get involved in this aspect. And I'm warning you that if they do in this, it's a slippery slope in itself. That is not saying that the talent's not there. That is simply saying when you accept a temporary solution, suddenly you get another temporary solution. And suddenly our companies can't move with the international nimbleness that I believe they need.
Now, I'm going to take some temporary special measures here because we don't have a lot of time, so we've got to move very quick. We're going to go Meredith, Janie, and someone else. Okay, so just one to someone or other. Meredith.
Meredith Alicar. I can't remember who the comedian was that used that expression, this is deja vu all over again, but I'm sitting here remembering 26 years ago, in 1984, when I was part of middle management at Esso, having all these discussions throughout the community. Absolutely not a thing I've heard is different. And so my question is, after 26 years, we actually have gone slightly backwards. How long do we wait for this change to happen? Because I'm getting too old and I've already got a 12-year-old daughter and I really would have loved it to have been right for her. And leave aside the philosophical, what is going to actually be different? Because
okay, right.
It's no different so far.
Who's going to respond?
I'm happy to start. I mean, I think I agree with David that the targets, we should give them a couple of years to see whether they deliver. But if the targets that businesses are setting are 2%, 5%, 10%, they're just not in the range, then I think we need to really open up this discussion about quotas. We need to really prescribe what the outcome is that we're looking for. That will create the critical mass. Then the change that you're talking about, Meredith, will happen rather than the other way around. So I would be in favour of moving to quotas within 5 years if we're not up at 40% gender neutral target.
You just took that so you could get a point in, rather. Meredith, my problem is I was around. I first took on a board seat 28 years ago. Boards were very different then. It's interesting, and I'd love to talk to you later. I don't remember this issue at all 28 years ago. For me, the biggest issue was that I was 27 years old. And they had great difficulties with that, and it was quite uncomfortable. That was 28 years ago. The time has come now. And I believe your 12-year-old, well, I won't say it's in the next 3 years, but by the time they're looking for a board seat, they'll be fine.
Now, we've got to finish this before the 12-year-old turns 30. Janie, yeah.
Childcare, but not just paid care, but the extended family idea that I think David was referring to. That, to me, seems very critical, because I have a child and it's very difficult. And without the extended family, notwithstanding the childcare, things do become very difficult. And I mean, it's something we probably can't change,
I'll make one comment on that. When I look at childcare in Australia compared to internationally, particularly Scandinavia, the fact is here in Australia, your childcare is your individual responsibility. So do you have a mum that doesn't work? Is your granny available? Have you got enough money to pay for long daycare? And let's face it, that's $100 to $120 per child per day. You need the CEO's job to pay for it. That's the type of analysis that women go through when they have children in Australia. In Scandinavia, I know that when I have a child, there is a guaranteed childcare place for my child, and the state picks up some of the responsibility for that. So there is quite a difference between childcare in other countries and childcare in here. And it's interesting, the Productivity Commission came out recently and said, well, if women don't have good childcare, guess what? They're not going to go to work. There's a strong correlation there. So I absolutely agree with you. We need to fix childcare in this country, and there's quite a deal of work that needs to be done.
I wish you'd put your special measures in so that we get childcare fixed, because I do agree with that. And it's interesting, at the university, childcare is an issue that actually comes to our council. We have our own childcare people, and it's something, to be honest, that has never come up at any board meeting of a for-profit institute. So what I'm saying to you is it's something that should be fixed. The other point is it could be fixed with a bit more imagination as well. I'm seeing an awful lot of very talented older people who would love to be involved in giving back and involved in childcare and all sorts of things. Why can't we work out some way of doing that? But the fact is we don't. So I think that's a much better place for intervention by government than quotas.
I'll go for buy.
There's a question right here.
John Atkin from the Trust Company. Speaking as a CEO, but I'm happy to say 60% of my direct reports are female. I agree with David philosophically, because I think if you introduce a compulsory element, it will ultimately confuse accountability. But I guess a suggestion to you is to take up, if the ASX has come out and mandated that people have got to publish targets, I would be picking up on the example coming out of consumer activist groups and then going to the institutional investors and asking them what is their investment policy towards companies that don't have appropriate targets and don't meet those targets, and actually put the pressure, the consumer pressure or the popular pressure onto the institutional shareholders, which I'm imagining that you would have no objection to, because it's consistent with the ownership responsibility they ultimately have.
Okay.
Don't wait for 5 years to worry about whether it's going to work or not, and then go for quotas. Move your attention onto those institutional shareholders.
It's a great point, John, and actually we're in discussion with institutional shareholders, proxy, shareholders association, whatever, because there is a strong correlation between improved corporate performance and greater gender diversity at the top. So it's about, you know, profitability and good corporate performance.
And not only am I in favour of it, I know it's going to happen, John. You've got it exactly right, and it should happen.
And a final question, Craig.
David, just given your role as chairman of a large corporation, and given I think everyone seems to agree that childcare is part of the solution here, I'd be interested to hear your views on whether corporations should share the burden of that cost. I mean, it's related to the current political debate as to where that cost should be borne, at the corporate or at the taxpayer level.
Yeah, I'm going to duck the question of who should bear the cost, but I do think it's an issue that has to be looked at. And as chairman of Coca-Cola Amatil, I know in our new building at Coke Place that this has been taken into account. It's the first sort of thing, in the, because it's a dynamic company. But I think it's something that the corporates have to start to look at.
It's all places there. Coke Place is just down the road from Mary McKillop Place. It's just
right across the road.
we can take a final question here. Yeah.
Hi, David, just two thoughts. The first thing you said, one of the things that you've said this evening, sorry, Nikki Wakes, is that women can stand on their own two feet. And in my view, women should have been able to stand on their own two feet for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. It's made no difference to representation in senior positions. So I don't understand the difference there. And then the next thing that concerns me slightly is we've been talking a little bit about defining what's required from people on boards and defining the skills and the needs. The skills that these people need to have. The thing that concerns me is right now, men are making those decisions, not women, because only 8.3% or now 9.3% of the people on the boards making the decisions about what's needed and the skills and the capabilities that are needed aren't women, they're men. So are those decisions necessarily right and creating a...
So we just have two final comments from Elizabeth and Davis.
Okay. look, I think it's a really valid point. The trickle-up effect will not work. We know that. I mean, just looking at law, 60 over 50% of graduates when I graduated in 1984 were women. Where are they at the top of law firms? We're down around 18% of equity partners. So trickle-up will not work. We need some greater action than that. And the other thing is, yes, when we look at merit, when we look at selection processes, merit is looked at through the view of the dominant grouping, and the dominant grouping on boards men, and the dominant grouping in business generally is men. So that's why I think we need to unpack what merit is, and that's why I adhere to advocate for quotas, because I think that actually a quota would allow women's merit to be uncovered. That's my final point, David.
As a special measure. Nikki, firstly, in terms of standing on one's 2 feet, my point was that I think times have changed. I accept absolutely, not the quota word, what Liz says about it being a men's problem. I believe that what is happening now, and I do believe it's going to happen before Meredith's daughter gets much older, is that men do understand that this is a mistake. And therefore, my point is that there are plenty of women who are meritorious and can stand on their own 2 feet, given that people are looking for talent. Why hasn't it happened? Because I don't think it was as big an issue. It may have been talked about, wasn't a big issue in the minds of a lot of us. It is now. The second point I'd make is times do change. And when you look over time, a lot of other things about boards have changed. Now, I won't go into it, but have a look at the Constitution and the other thing. They may all be men, but they often are a different type of male. Have a look at it. I mean, you know, when I used to work with you occasionally, they were different people giving us instructions in those days.
Many thanks. I know there are a lot of people who had more points to make, but we always finish on 7 o'clock, and it's 7 o'clock, so I'll finish, and I'll be very brief. Look, I think it's been a terrific discussion. There's been a lot of agreement. There's been some disagreement, but we've had a terrific discussion, which is consistent with what we do at the Sydney Institute. It would be great to publish both the papers of David Gonski and Elizabeth Broderick and to have their talks up on the podcast. I've learned a lot tonight, and I just know there's a lot of interest in the room. So I'd just like to say to both our speakers and to Carol Schwartz for introduction, thanks very much and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.